loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we talk about Democratic Party leadership attacking progressive ideas like Medicare for All that voters support. Next, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that death penalty executions can be painful and they don't qualify as torture. Then, British Prime Minister Theresa May met with her cabinet at length today about next moves on Brexit. And then, the NATO military alliance is meeting this week in their 70th year, and there are many counterconferences and demonstrations planned. And finally, Congress killed a bill yesterday that would provide aid to Puerto Rico. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. According to Saudi officials and the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi's four children are now being provided million-dollar homes in Saudi Arabia and monthly payments of at least $10,000 each. This arrangement was approved late last year by King Salman. The officials say that the arrangements are for, quote, ensuring that they continue to show restraint in their public statements about the killing of their father by Saudi operatives, close quote. The United States has stopped the delivery of F-35 stealth fighter aircraft to Turkey, stating that they won't deliver the weapons without a clear decision that Turkey is forgoing Russia's S-400 missile defense system. The F-35 is built by weapons giant Lockheed Martin. Turkey has said that it will have the S-400s delivered in July. Senator Bernie Sanders has now raised $18 million since launching his presidential campaign, with an average donation in February and March of only $20. A majority of his contributors are under 39 years old and gave under $200. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Capitol Hill. According to a new report, a top aide to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi asked lobbyists in a private meeting to raise public doubts about Medicare for All, saying that the progressive program would detract from Democrats' agenda. We're joined from Baltimore by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's a medical doctor and the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out their fine work at www.popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Margaret.
So thank you for having me.
First of all, Margaret, I have to ask you, are you surprised by this at all?
No, not at all. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has been pretty clear that she's not a big supporter of National Improved Medicare for All, and she's the leadership of the Democratic Party. You don't get there unless you've raised a lot of money.
So if the Democrats are not going to push an agenda that would allow for Medicare for All, or really for any kind of reform of Obamacare to make it more easily and freely accessible to Americans, especially poor Americans, what is it that the Democrats are willing to do in this legislative session?
So this has been, you know, the long time practice of the Democrats since the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010. And we have to recognize that the Affordable Care Act was written by and for the health insurance industry and has been very profitable for all of the various sectors, the private health insurers, the private hospitals, the pharmaceutical corporations. And so what we've been hearing all along is, oh, our first responsibility is to protect the Affordable Care Act. That means protect our funders' profits. And Medicare for All is a great idea, and maybe someday we'll get to it.
Yeah, I don't think I understand fully the Republicans' strategy here. I don't see how the Republicans expect to win votes on the healthcare issue when exit polls showed that 41% of voters in the last election said that healthcare was the number one issue to them personally. I don't see how they expect to win votes when they continue to support programs and policies that would really prohibit people from getting health care if they have pre-existing conditions. Am I missing something here? Is there something in this Republican program or the Republican proposal that the Democrats ought to be giving consideration to? Is there room to negotiate some sort of an agreement with the Republicans, or the two sides just too far apart?
Well, I think that, you know, the Republicans must have short memories because they don't remember, you know, the summer when they tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act and so many people rose up and fought back and, you know, protested in Congress. And even John McCain ended up voting to protect, you know, prevent that repeal from happening. The Republicans have never put forward a proposal that would actually do anything to improve, our healthcare system in the United States. Democrats are really missing an opportunity because people people are experiencing the realities of the Affordable Care Act, that premiums continue to go up, that they continue to struggle to see the doctor that they need to see. And, you know, instead of just clinging on to this failed strategy of, oh, let's see if we can make the ACA better, they really should be listening to the voters right now who overwhelmingly want national improved Medicare for all and get the courage to actually do something to fight for it. That would be a winning strategy that would just blow the Republicans away, put them in the dust.
Margaret Flowers is our guest. Dr. Flowers, I know you've been traveling, so you may have missed this, but in the last week, there were numerous media articles that started appearing in the New York Times, Fortune Magazine, then on mainstream media about what a catastrophe it would be if we didn't have private health insurance companies. And it's like this disingenuous but obviously coordinated effort, including lots of quotable quotes from Democratic Party leaders saying that while it may have a lot of problems, the current healthcare system uses or employs, meaning the insurance companies, about $600 billion in capital, and that will disappear if the industry disappears, which of course it should disappear, and it should be replaced by Medicare for all or an improved Medicare for all. I don't know if you saw those articles, but it seems to me that there is a coordinated think tank sort of offensive going on. So you have Republicans who are basically, their basic program is vote for us and we'll take away your health care. The Democrats are vote for us and we're going to keep your current lousy health care. The people like Bernie Sanders and others who are on the left, and certainly yourself and Popular Resistance demanding improved Medicare for all. It seems to me that the tide obviously is turning against the current system. And so now we're seeing this ideological sort of talking points offensive that's being waged. If the private insurance companies were replaced with Medicare for all, explain why it would not be in any way a disaster for the American people.
Right. Imagine this. Imagine that you never had to look at a health insurance plan again, that you never had to fight with your employer about whether you could get a good plan or keep the plan you have, you know, or could you get a raise or was that going to go to pay for your increased premium? You know, people don't love their private health insurance for good reason, because they don't ever get to keep it for very long. It's expensive, and they have a lot of out-of-pocket expenses that they have to pay before they get their health care. So under a national improved Medicare for all healthcare system, it's one single system. It's paid for up front through taxes. Every person is in it for their entire life. It covers all of their medically necessary care, and you no longer need to, you know, worry about whether you can get the health care you need. We don't need the private insurance companies. They don't add anything to our system except a lot of obstacles to care and a lot of expenses. So it's, you know, moving to a national improved Medicare for all would funnel our money towards providing care. There's still going to be a lot of healthcare spending. We're still going to have hospitals and doctors and nurses and all sorts of clinics and, you know, medical device companies and pharmaceutical companies. But instead of wasting so much money on these profiteers and bureaucratic, you know, paperwork, we're actually going to have a system that provides care.
You know, the funny thing too is that we've got all these different Democratic presidential candidates. They all have a variation of the same healthcare program. But then the Democratic leadership just says, no, we're not doing that. When I talk to friends overseas, they're just amazed at the notion that we have private health insurance companies. Like they can't even wrap their minds around what it means to have a company making a profit off of your health. And, you know, these aren't, I'm not talking about third and fourth world countries. I'm talking about European countries. They just can't understand why in the United States, healthcare is not a basic human right. So you have Democrats running for president trying to convey the notion that healthcare is a basic human right. And then the Democratic legislative leadership saying, no, we're going to play ball with the insurance companies.
Well, we see how powerful these insurance companies are. And we see what happened to Kamala Harris when she dared to say that we didn't need private health insurance companies. And then very shortly after that, had to start walking that back. You know, as soon as they see legislators that are moving, you know, towards impacting their profits, they step in, and they step in with their threats of, you know, withdrawing their support, with their talking points that people in Congress need to use if they want to continue to maintain their support. So it's no surprise that we're hearing all of the Democrats saying the same thing, saying, you know, oh, well, this is a really big change. We really want to get there. Maybe someday we will. But right now we have to, you know, protect ourselves from the Republicans who are threatening, you know, what we have. And the biggest way that they could protect, you know, people is to stop being on the defensive of, you know, saying, well, the Republicans are going to take this away and we have to protect it, and go on the offense and say, hey, we're actually going to solve the problem with what the majority of people want.
In the last minute and a half, can you tell us if you see that as a real possibility? Do you see it? Let's make a leap, a political leap here, and say that we're going to enter a post-Trump era in 2020. Do you see significant substantive changes to the healthcare situation?
I think it completely depends on us as people. I don't think that we can rely on, you know, getting rid of Trump or replacing the, you know, presidency or Congress with Democrats as a solution, because, you know, here we see that they are also indebted to the Wall Street. And so what I do see is a groundswell of people, more and more people who are supporting National Improved Medicare for All and who are recognizing that we're going to have to actually fight for it if we want to win it. And if we continue to build that, I do see that we're in a position where we could win. We're moving in that direction, but there's a lot of obstacles we still have to get through. But if we continue to mobilize, we can win this.
Do you think it's going to take a combination of Democrats controlling both houses of Congress and a progressive Democratic presidential nominee or Democratic president, or do you think that there's some wiggle room there?
I think that, again, it's the people. I mean, we experienced this in 2009 when 80% of Democratic voters wanted a single-payer system. We had President Obama in the White House. We had Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, and yet single-payer was off the table. So I don't think that's what's going to win it. What's going to win it is when the people are demanding it, and you know, policymakers feel they have no other choice. It's just like the way that we stopped the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It became politically toxic for anybody, whether they're Republican or Democrat, to support it. We need to make National Improved Medicare for All so, you know, so politically necessary that no matter who wants to get elected, they need to support it.
That's the key, John.
That is the key, Brian. Well, we're out of time. We were joined by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's a medical doctor and the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can find their work at www.popularresistance.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In a 5-4 vote yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that there is no constitutional guarantee that an execution must be painless, saying that a Missouri prisoner may be executed despite having a rare condition that could cause him to suffocate. Trump appointee Neil Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion, which was joined by President Trump's other Supreme Court pick, Brett Kavanaugh. We're joined from Connecticut by Stephen Bright. He's a professor at Yale Law School, and he's the former director of the Southern Center for Human Rights. Welcome, Professor Bright.
Thank you for having me.
This looks like the conservative takeover of the Supreme Court. This is what the Republicans and the conservatives have been wanting to do for a long time. And now it's having a real honest-to-God impact on an issue of national import. We've seen a lot of states across the country, many southern states, institute a moratorium on executions because this question of whether or not lethal injection was painful had not been settled. Well, now it doesn't matter if it's painful or not. An execution can now go forward. What do you make of this?
Well, this is a clear example of the difference in the court, with Justice Kennedy no longer on the court and Justice Kavanaugh on in his place. This was a very narrow question that was really before the court because, as you said, this man had a very unusual condition where he had these tumors filled with blood all on his throughout his throat and so forth. And if he's subject to lethal injection, it will be a unbearable choking and convulsing suffocation while he dies. That was really what was at stake here, and the court could have decided something much more narrowly, but instead has some rather sweeping language about saying that the person has no right to a painless death. And that unless the state has done something to super add torture and unnecessary pain to the execution process, it passes constitutional muster. And then at the end, the court adds some language about speeding up executions and not granting stays at the last minute, which was not an issue in this case at all. This case had been the Supreme Court was very closely divided. The Court of Appeals that had heard this case was very closely decided. The district court took this case very seriously. There's nothing in this case about delaying executions or frivolous appeals. This is obviously a very substantial issue, which was before the court.
I wanted to ask, too, if this is going to open the floodgates for executions now. This is something that so many states were waiting to hear about. Is it going to make it easier for states to acquire the chemicals necessary to begin executing people? Or is this so narrowly defined that it really won't have a broader impact?
Well, what it will do is make it harder for anyone else to come and challenge a method of execution. Part of what this decision depends upon is his ability to identify a feasible and readily implemented alternative to lethal injection. For some reason, he did not advocate the firing squad, which would have been a much more clearly painless instant death if it had been used. It has been used in Utah, so it's not totally unheard of. But for some reason, he proposed nitrogen gas, and this has not been tried by anybody anywhere. Some states have adopted it and say they're going to use it going forward, but that's partly why he lost the case. So there may still be some litigation about this. I don't think there are any floodgates to be open, because I don't think there are any states waiting for this decision before they go forward with executions. The number of death sentences being imposed in the courts and the number of executions that are taking place has been on a very steady decline since the year 2000. We just don't have very many executions anymore, but the inability to make lethal injection work the way it was supposed to has been a real problem for the states that do carry out executions, the few that carry out executions.
We're speaking from Connecticut with Professor Stephen Bright. He's a professor at Yale Law School and the former director of the Southern Center for Human Rights.
Professor, there was a moratorium on executions initiated by the federal government in the late 1960s. There was, about a 10-year moratorium. The death penalty was basically voided or suspended, maybe is a better way to say it, for that decade. What you're telling us now is that very few executions take place. Now, there are lots of crimes that would be considered capital crimes or capital equivalent crimes. It would seem thus that whether an individual is executed or not depends on where they live, depends perhaps on their race, maybe the race of the victim, bad luck. Again, the arbitrariness of the death penalty, given the fact that it's not applied with any sort of equal standard, it would seem on its face that it would defy both legal standards and social policy. Should the death penalty be abolished?
Well, it's just what you just said. It's only imposed in a very small number of counties in the entire United States. Back in the 1990s, we were putting, or at least about 290 to 310 people were being sentenced to death every year. Last year, it was only 41. We got as high as 98 executions back in the 90s. Now the number of executions in a year is about 25 or less. So there's a huge decline. And as there has been this decline, the death penalty is more and more arbitrary. That is, it's limited to a few counties in Texas, Riverside, California, some counties in Florida account for most of the people who are being sentenced to death and most of the people who are being executed. So it's very rare. The Washington Supreme Court not long ago concluded that under its state constitution that the death penalty was unconstitutional because it was imposed so rarely, and the imposition of the death penalty was influenced so much by race. That's true all over the country. It's just that's the one state Supreme Court that's looked at that and called it for what it is. arbitrary and discriminatory in the imposition of the death penalty.
Professor, there are 2,621 people on death row across the country right now. Do you think that because of this decision, we'll see states try to more actively begin executing prisoners?
Well, the review process takes some period of time. This case did, took 20 years. But you got to remember, this case only took that long because of the last 6 or so years of litigating the lethal injection question. But I think also in some places that while there's sort of support for the death penalty in the abstract, there's less and less support for it when it comes to actually tying people down and putting them down. And so often we find in these cases, just like this one, we have these terrible medical problems that are going to come into play if this man is put to death by lethal injection. We have issues of innocence in many cases. We have issues of mental health and whether some people that are about to be executed are really competent, where they really understand what's going on. I mean, there's just it's never as clean as people think about it when you just think about it in the abstract.
As the Supreme Court comes down with decisions like this, are we going to see more executions now? Now that these two Trump nominees have pushed the court to the more conservative side on this issue, is that going to encourage states to try to clear out their death rows?
I don't think so. I think what these cases are moving along through the state and federal courts the way they always have. There may be some other measures, but these cases just take some time because of what's involved. People's lives are at stake. And generally, the courts, even if they may ultimately uphold the death penalty, do take a look at these cases before. And that takes some time because you first go through the state courts and then you go through these cases first go through the state courts. And then go through the federal courts. I think we will see in the Supreme Court cases that are going to be decided differently because of Kavanaugh's presence on the court in place of Justice Kennedy. This is probably an example of that, although it's not crystal clear. Certainly the harshness of the language would not have been the same if Justice Kennedy were on the court. But recently we saw the court vacate a stay in an Alabama case because a Muslim person who was being put to death could not have his spiritual advisor with him. But then just last week, we saw the court stay in execution out of Texas where a Buddhist man was not allowed to have his spiritual advisor, both close calls. So the court is still sorting some of this out. The Alabama case where they vacated the stay was a real shock because it really was a very significant First Amendment question there about allowing Christian spiritual advisors to minister to people facing execution, but not other religions.
So is there any chance at all that this Supreme Court, with its current construct, would take up the idea of the overall constitutionality of the death penalty? Is there any chance that this Supreme Court would rule the death penalty unconstitutional?
Well, certainly not at this time. I mean, the language of this case that you're talking about clearly is very harsh. In fact, Justice Gorsuch at one point says, you know, the death penalty can be repealed by the people in their legislatures, but it's not for the court to do that. There's a majority opinion of 5 justices of the Supreme Court, so I think that forecloses any suggestion that this court would be entertaining a claim that the death penalty, as it's applied today, is unconstitutional. If you went back and applied the decision that the court handed down in 1972, finding the death penalty unconstitutional because of its arbitrariness, because of the discrimination in the way it was carried out, it's almost exactly the same today as it was then, but the composition of the court is very different, and that makes all the difference in the world.
That was the voice of Professor Stephen Bright. He's a professor at Yale Law School and the former director of the Southern Center for Human Rights. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. UK Prime Minister Theresa May held a marathon cabinet meeting today to discuss the ongoing crisis around the country's departure from the European Union and announced that she would be seeking an extension to the Article 50 deadline. This comes one day after UK lawmakers failed again to back any alternatives to Prime Minister May's Brexit deal. We're joined from London by Alex Gordon, former president of the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Alex, welcome back.
Hi, John. Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. As we're fond to say here, Alex, Americans don't understand how their own government works, so they're definitely not going to understand what's going on in the UK and how your government works. But let's talk about what...
Yeah, join the club. Join the club.
Exactly. So let's talk about Article 50 was invoked to trigger the two-year period by which the Britain would have to leave the European Union. That deadline was March 29th. What does it mean that Theresa May is asking now for an extension for Article 50? Now, the EU had set its own deadline of April 12th. That's coming up in less than 10 days now, or a little bit more than 10 days. What happens next and what does this mean?
She's already asked for an extension to the Article 50 process. That's why we haven't left the European Union 2 days ago. And that is why she's been forced to go groveling to the European Commission and the European Council of Prime Ministers, effectively heads of state of the other 27 member states of the European Union, to ask for an extension for 2 weeks to take us to the 12th of April. Now, what she's announced this afternoon, following 8 hours of this morning they met her cabinet at 9 o'clock London time. She assembled a circular firing squad and their guns jammed. And this has been happening now for weeks and weeks and weeks. It's described the Tory party, the British Conservative Party, the longest running, oldest ruling class party in the world, was being described last week by the chief whip, that is, which is a kind of a term used to describe the chair of the disciplinary process for their members of parliament, was described as being the most dysfunctional government in history. They've decided yet again to try to seek further time. And in fact, what she said this afternoon is that she's seeking a short extension, as short as possible, in order to allow either her deal to be agreed or another deal to be agreed, or to leave without a deal on terms that are negotiated. But in reality, she's out of time. So this is what you're seeing unraveling in real time, is a political and state crisis of one of the most important states in the world. Britain's empire was the largest empire of the last century, of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. Its ruling class is now in complete meltdown, deadlock, unable to reach a decision, unable to reach a consensus, unable to smuggle their class interests past the interests of the majority of the population over here, which was their historic purpose. The Conservative Party has always been the vehicle for promoting the interests of the British ruling class as the interests of the nation. And they've simply been unable to do that over this question of Brexit. So what it means is she's going to go running along on the 10th of April, in just over a week's time, to the European Council of Ministers and ask them for a further extension to Article 50 beyond the 12th of April. It seems extremely possible that the European Council are going to refuse that because they've seen the shambolic state of her government. They know that she cannot deliver. She can't deliver within her own cabinet, and she can't deliver within the House of Commons, the British Parliament. So everyone is asking the question over here, what's going to happen? Some of the best-informed commentators think that still the most likely outcome of this whole mess is that Britain will leave the European Union on the 12th of April without a deal with the European Union, that is to say, leave on World Trade Organization terms. The other possibility is that the House of Commons will effectively launch a parliamentary coup d'etat and revoke the entire departure process, revoke Article 50, and decide that they're going to remain in the European Union. If they do that, they will reap a whirlwind because there's going to be a complete breakdown of established party politics in Britain. We're absolutely here trying to work out in real time what's going on, just as you are. And I can assure you, Brian and John, British commentators and British viewers have no more idea than your own audience what the British political ruling class is up to.
That's the voice of Alex Gordon. We're talking to Alex from London. He is the former president of the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. Alex, we have the EU. They said, well, look, March 29th, the 2-year end of the Article 50 process, is no longer March 29th. It's April 12th. Now, what Theresa May is coming back again, and sort of, as you put, she's on her knees now. She's no longer in control of the process at all. She's at their whim and at their mercy. If they say, look, you can only get a majority for no, you've never been able to muster a majority for yes, we can't keep going, we're distracted from other pressing problems, there's no hope, you're not giving us any real sense that 2 more weeks will make a difference. Okay, you're out. Britain, Brexit is actually happening without a deal. What then happens from the point of view of trade between Britain and the EU or the EU countries? What happens with the border in Ireland?
Well, the first question, what happens with trade? The fact is that the UK civil service, the British civil service, one of the oldest civil services in the world, has made extensive preparations. There will be small dislocations in trade. Everything has been taken into account. There will not be a catastrophe. There will not be a meltdown in trade. The prices of food will not skyrocket. There will not be a closure, a mass closure of factories because they can't get spare parts. There's been a huge Project Fear mounted in the last 2 or 3 months around these issues for the consequences of trade. But it's quite clear that there will be a Brexit under World Trade Organization rules. The British government has published its proposals for the impact on tariffs. In effect, the duty-free ratio of tariffs will move from 80% at current levels on goods imported into Britain to 87%. So there'll be an increase in reductions in tariffs into Britain. This will depend on which sector you're talking about, whether it's agriculture or manufactured goods or pharmaceuticals. But there will be a change in tariff rules, but it's going to be a dislocation rather than a catastrophe. In terms of the Irish border, which you've just mentioned, I mean, I've just come back from a school in Ireland on the border, discussing with Irish trade unionists and socialists and Republicans from north and south of the border, the impact of Brexit on the border. I have to say the impact is going to be extremely minimal in terms of the daily lives of people who live around the border of Northern Ireland. Much of this fear has been stoked up by the Irish government at the behest of the European Commission. In the view of Irish Republicans, who I've spoken to in Ireland, they're incredulous at the suggestions that an Irish government might impose border controls between the north and the south of Ireland when the British Conservative government is saying that under no circumstances would they impose border controls. I mean, we may end up with a situation in a few years' time where there's a Sinn Féin coalition government in the Republic of Ireland, which is being ordered by the European Commission to put up border posts between Ireland, north and south, and potentially a British government saying that they're refusing to recognize that there's any border between Ireland, north and south, which would be a kind of historic reversal of the position that's pertained all the way through the 20th century. The border in Northern Ireland has been used cynically by the European Commission and by the European the Irish government to try to put pressure on the British in the negotiations. I don't think it is a major issue in reality.
That is extremely important for us to hear and know because, again, being here, we don't really have, and not having been to Ireland, we don't really know. But that's a fascinating sort of prognosis. Alex, in our last 15 seconds, what you're basically saying, if I'm hearing you right, if Britain leaves the EU on April 12th, the sky will not fall.
The sky sky won't fall, but if Britain doesn't leave on April the 12th, if there's a long extension, and if the Article 50 process is revoked by the House of Commons, which is dominated by MPs who want to remain in the European Union, there will be a major political crisis in Britain, because the majority of the population has taken, or the majority of the electorate has voted to leave the European Union, and such a act of treachery would be paid back with real vengeance. And we would see really a breaking of the existing party system of Labour and Conservative, and the emergence of new forces that we can't really contemplate entirely at this moment.
We're going to leave it right there. We were joined from London by Alex Gordon. Alex is the former president of the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
NATO foreign ministers are meeting in Washington this week to mark the 70th anniversary of the alliance's creation. The agenda also includes NATO relations with Russia, the fight against terrorism, and military spending. A myriad of peace groups are planning demonstrations opposing the meeting, and one major event is being planned for Thursday, right here in Washington. We're joined from Washington by Ann Wright. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became a prominent anti-war activist. Welcome back, Ann.
Thank you.
And tell us a little bit about this NATO meeting. Is the purpose as light as the press releases want us to believe?
I don't think so. I think it's a continuation of 70 years of expansion of NATO to challenge after the Cold War had ended, and 20 years of relative good relations with Russia. All of a sudden, NATO countries pushed by the United States have ramped up again the Cold War rhetoric and actions. So NATO is expanding, and it's a dangerous move.
What about the demonstrations? Tell us what different groups are planning.
Well, we had a demonstration on Saturday, a No to NATO. We have others on Wednesday and Thursday. It's to bring attention to our policymakers, both at the White House and at the Congress, that we do not believe expansion of NATO is what should be going on, nor do we believe that the current group of NATO should be taking such aggressive action toward Russia.
Yeah, Ann Wright is our guest. And, you know, at the end of the Cold War, and as the Soviet Union was collapsing, James Baker, who was then Secretary of State for the George H.W. Bush administration, met with Mikhail Gorbachev, the leader of the Soviet Union. The U.S. at that time was promising there would no, if the Berlin Wall, since the Berlin Wall had come down, Warsaw Pact was dissolving, that was the socialist bloc, sort of mirror equivalent military alliance, that was no longer in existence, that the U.S. promised that NATO would not expand eastward towards Russia. Now, let's help our audience that, you know, especially younger folks who may not fully understand why the steady march eastward of NATO and the incorporation of all of the Eastern and Central European countries and governments that were, in fact, allies of Russia and the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but have now been incorporated into NATO. Why would that be perceived in Russia as such an existential threat?
Well, indeed. I mean, it is astounding that here you have the agreement of the U.S. government with the Soviet Union that with the demise of the Soviet Union, the NATO and U.S. would not poach the countries that had been the defensive bulwark for the Soviet Union, that Warsaw Pact group, that indeed the West would leave them alone. But very quickly, and by that time I had transferred over from the military into the State Department, very quickly here was this new program called Partnerships for Peace that was the enticement for various countries of the Warsaw Pact to start having dealings with NATO, having some military exercises with them, and then later on came the formal admission of those countries into NATO. And by the original group, I think of 22 nations, expanded by 19 nations very quickly. And by the end of the 1990s, NATO had expanded into exactly the places the U.S. government had said that it would not do.
Yeah. And right, here's another question. NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The last time I looked at a map, Afghanistan was not close to the North Atlantic, nor was Libya. Again, does it seem to you that NATO, while it appears as a multilateral military formation, is basically a convenient tool for U.S. Foreign policy or U.S. military operations in far-flung places of the world? And why would that be acceptable to European countries who are part of NATO?
Well, indeed, it's amazing how the NATO mandate has been expanded by the United States and how all these European countries have gone along with it. It's very interesting. Not only is the place where NATO operations are taking place, which are totally away from the location of NATO countries in primarily Central Europe, but to have had those operations in Afghanistan and in Libya, but now countries that are off the European continent, Colombia is already a member of NATO, and Brazil is apparently going to apply for membership and no doubt will be given that membership with the push of the U.S. government. So it's becoming a much different organization than what was envisioned 70 years ago.
You know, I was going through the belongings of someone who passed away a little while ago, and she was an older woman. And I was looking through Life and Saturday Evening Post magazines that she had from 1960 and 61. And there was one thing that really jumped out at me. It was this quote. It was a speech by John F. Kennedy talking about the almost unimaginable losses that the Soviets suffered in World War II. He said 20 million people suffered, 20 million people died. This was the biggest battlefield loss in the history of the human race that the Soviets endured during those 5 years. And I was thinking, like, gosh, that was 1961 in the middle of the Cold War, right? And here we are, you know, 60 or not quite 60, but almost approaching 60 years later. If somebody, an American political leader, certainly the president, were to talk sort of in a sympathetic or empathetic way about what Russia or the Soviets experienced in the defeat of fascism, they'd be considered like a stooge of the Kremlin. I mean, and the Cold War's over. NATO's still in existence. NATO's not dissolving. It's expanding. And the rhetoric is more hostile than 1961.
And plus, there are these what are called major non-NATO allies. You know, countries like Bahrain and Singapore that have nothing to do with NATO but are treated as NATO-like.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ann.
Well, it is unbelievable what is occurring, but I think it all goes back to the concerns that we all have about the growth of the military-industrial complex. In order to sell weapons, you need to have an enemy, and the enemy during the Cold War that sold lots of weapons for NATO was the Soviet Union. We've had 20 years of peace and quiet. The policymakers who get paid off by the weapons industry, they've already had wars in Iraq. They've had wars in Afghanistan. They need another enemy to keep selling all these weapons. And so the rhetoric starts getting hotter and hotter and hotter, and nobody knows the history. I mean, it's incredible how we in the United States just do not look at history. And as you say, 20 million people from Russia, Soviet Union, were killed during World War II, and they remember what it's like. There is a genetic memory from World War II, that the leadership of now Russia is not about to let anybody threaten them again.
Yeah, I think what Ann is doing, what other anti-war organizations are doing, is very important, because if you think of NATO as just, you know, in essence, a pretext to carry out more military spending, and Donald Trump is demanding that the NATO countries spend more. Obama demanded the same thing, by the way, the 2%.
Sure.
Gross domestic product.
And I think only two countries actually met that target.
They met the goal. They don't actually want to spend, you know, Europeans don't actually want to throw their currency, their euros down the drain or the toilet to buy more and more weapons. They'd rather actually use it. But there's this relentless pressure, first by Obama, but really more so under Trump. And some people were criticizing Trump for being, quote, hostile or negative to NATO. It seemed to me he was just squeezing the NATO countries to spend more and more and more. That's not hostility. That's just pressure.
That's right. I think his comments, they're being interpreted as hostile, but it's, following through on his campaign promise to get everybody to pay a share, or their what is called their equal share. But the reality is he hasn't done anything to stop NATO exercises. In fact, they've increased. They increased under Obama, and now they've increased under Trump. The largest military exercises in the history of the world since the Cold War ended are going on this year. So it's not like the Trump administration is backing off NATO at all. They and the companies that benefit from this are right there, right in the middle of it, pushing as many military exercises in Scandinavia and the Balkans as they possibly can.
Yeah. I just wonder, I mean, when you think about it also, Germany today, here we are, almost 75 years after the end of World War
II. That's right.
American troops and rights still are occupying Germany. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, Germany is the leading economic power in Europe, the anchor of the EU. Why are U.S. troops in Germany?
Well, indeed, it's Japan, South Korea, and Germany are the places where we have the top three number of troops outside the United States. And it's a throwback to World War II, where the policymakers say, well, we've got to keep a bulwark of Americans there just in case we need them. And of course, those bases have been used for the prosecution of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. The air bases were used to transit military aircraft. So it's part of the little aircraft carrier of the United States that keeps moving around. But Germany has been a stalwart to allow the United States to use its territory for wars on other countries.
And let me ask you what may be a silly question. We just have 1 minute left. But I remember during the George H.W. Bush administration, and then in the beginning of the Clinton administration, there was talk about inviting Russia to join NATO. Whatever happened to that idea?
Well, you know, it is a very interesting question. I don't know what happened to it, other than that would be one enemy less we had. And I suspect the weapons guys and gals went, because it's mostly women that are now running the big military industries around. They said, well, how can they be our enemy if they're in NATO? So we got to keep them out, and we got to make sure that they stay our enemy so we can sell these weapons.
I think that's probably what it comes down to. We'll leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Ann Wright. Ann is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and who became a prominent anti-war activist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Senate Democrats last night killed a bill that would have provided aid to Puerto Rico because it did not go far enough. President Trump, who publicly opposes any aid to Puerto Rico, lashed out at the island and its elected officials on Twitter overnight, saying that Puerto Rico is, quote, a mess, unquote, and that its politicians are, quote, incompetent and corrupt, unquote. The mayor of San Juan responded by saying, quote, he can huff and puff all he wants, but he cannot escape the deaths of 3,000 people on his watch. Shame on you, unquote. We're joined from Michigan by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She is the department chair and associate professor of anthropology at Kalamazoo College. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
We've had this conversation a number of times, and the economic and infrastructure situation in Puerto Rico has not gotten any better. Now, not only does Puerto Rico get no aid because Congress couldn't agree on an aid bill, but you have the president picking a fight yet again and attacking not just the politicians in Puerto Rico, but the whole of the island. What do you make of this?
Well, I woke up this morning to those tweets, and like many other people, found them to be just unconscionable and rude. And as everything that Trump does, profoundly misleading and misrepresenting of the actual situation. I think that Trump would like to give Puerto Rico the same treatment that he's giving Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. If he could, he would do that. And the only reason he hasn't done it is because he's bound by Congress to actually include Puerto Rico in federal disaster relief. But if he could get out of it, I mean, clearly that's what he wants, is to say no more money. And he keeps saying that $98 billion have been sent to Puerto Rico already, which is just an outright lie. I mean, it's completely false. So, but, you know, like Trump's gift is that he mixes in a bit of truth into every craziness, every crazy thing that he says. And most of what he says is absolute craziness. But once in a while, he says something true. And that is how he sort of keeps it going, you know. And in the case of Puerto Rico's politicians, I actually agree with him. I do think that they are corrupt and inept, but no more corrupt and inept than he is. I mean, there's no one more corrupt and inept than Donald Trump in this situation, right? So it's the pot getting the calling the kettle black, yeah? But certainly that rings true with many Puerto Ricans as well. And it's actually how he builds support among people in Puerto Rico who are disaffected from politics as usual, in the same way that he built support among people in the United States, in the continental United States, who were disaffected from politics as usual. But of course, with the caveat that despite thinking that he represents some kind of alternative to politics as usual, in reality, what we have is a deep entrenchment of corporate interest and a near totalitarian state with regards to presidential executive powers, no? So I think that what we're seeing play out is, unfortunately, Puerto Rico being used as a kind of hot potato between the Democrats and the Republicans, both of whom would like to capitalize on the strong sentiments, both of Puerto Ricans and the anti-immigrant sentiments about Puerto Ricans, in order to move forward their political platform.
Tell us also, what exactly does Puerto Rico need right now? Has the island recovered from back-to-back hurricanes? What exactly does the island need to rebuild its infrastructure at this point?
Well, Puerto Rico needs money, but more than money, what Puerto Rico needs is democracy, is decolonization. That's what Puerto Rico needed before Maria, and it's definitely what Puerto Rico needs now more than ever after Maria. I remind you that the United Nations Decolonization Committee voted unanimously last year to demand a decolonization process for Puerto Rico, and that has simply been ignored because the United States apparently doesn't believe in the United Nations anymore, so doesn't participate in their decision-making and doesn't respond to any decisions made by the UN. So Puerto Rico's case has become acute in regards to the political and economic crisis that Puerto Ricans are living in. The situation in Puerto Rico is still difficult with regards to infrastructure, and the basics of life are still difficult for people. And psychologically, it's very difficult to be living in this state of, you know, not only limbo in terms of not actually receiving the aid that keeps getting talked about in the media and keeps being promise but never arrives, and also the expectation that that aid will be actually, most of it will probably be stolen by corrupt politicians and their friends, but also this kind of psychic dissonance that comes from knowing that that the situation is terrible in Puerto Rico, and that people need help, and there being a conversation in the United States about Puerto Rico from Donald Trump on down that basically represents Puerto Ricans as undeserving, as criminals, as dangerous, as stupid or inept or incapable of self-government, which is on the one hand par for the course in terms of the historical representation of Puerto Ricans and U.S. politics, and also intimately linked to the kind of racist anti-immigrant policies that we have seen throughout the Trump administration implemented not only against Central Americans and South Americans, but also against Muslims and against people from the Middle East. So I think that we need to make those connections beyond Puerto Rico to the rest of the Third World, to the rest of the Global South, and understand that this is a process of imperialism, a process of colonial exploitation that is taking place in Puerto Rico, and that can only be resolved through decolonization. And that is what Puerto Rico needs today.
We are speaking from Michigan with Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She is the department chair and associate professor of anthropology at Kalamazoo College. Brian, inherent poverty is a major problem in Puerto Rico still.
Yeah. And as the professor said, an outcome of colonialization. In 2014, the U.S. Census estimated that 58% of Puerto Rican children, 58%, live below the federal poverty level. That number might actually be higher. It might be closer to 65%. That would be almost 7 out of every 10 Puerto Rican children living below the federal poverty line. And the federal poverty line is a joke because actually you could be twice the level of the federal poverty level in terms of income and you'd still be very, very poor. Go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, the poverty in Puerto Rico has become extreme since Maria, but also since the financial crisis, the economic crisis began around 2006, 2 years before the crisis really was felt in the United States. So it has been a long time since people in Puerto Rico felt that they were capable of economically progressing or improving their lot or improving the lot of their children. A lot of what is being talked about in terms of this aid package is actually just ongoing payments to the food nutritional assistance program in Puerto Rico, which is just a basic social welfare, you know, program. And we really are seeing people's lives being played with when we're talking about food, access to food, as well as access to education. We've seen a slashing of the university budget to half of its previous budget. The university is under literally half of the budget was cut.
Well, you can't survive something.
Right. So the university has been the way that working class people have made it possible for themselves to get better jobs, to get higher paying jobs, to move up the social ladder. If indeed that has been possible, it has been possible through public education. And so that has also been a big part of the kind of genocidal political impulse that the United States has demonstrated in Puerto Rico, and to say nothing of the healthcare situation, which is likewise literally genocidal, I think. And so, you know, the question of poverty has to be looked at beyond just the question of income. Income is part of it. But the question of poverty is also related to these other social indicators that are fundamental in terms of people's ability to not only to survive, but also to thrive and to hope for a better future for their children. And I think Puerto Ricans are having a hard time doing that right now, imagining that they could provide a better future, or that they might be a better future for their children in Puerto Rico. And that is the reason behind the large scale migration that we have seen out of Puerto Rico. Over the last 5 to 7 years, we have seen nearly a quarter of a million, or some people say up to half a million people leaving the island with the hopes that they can find employment in the United States. And so I really do think that the intent here is to create a kind of social panic around Puerto Rican migration, around Puerto Rican citizenship, and to create a kind of consensus on the right that is just as mad and sort of frothing at the mouth as it is around the question of Mexican and Central American immigration. So I think they want to, the Trump and his administration would like U.S. Americans to feel that there's a horde of Puerto Ricans trying to beat down the door and take all the money from the budget.
We have about 40 seconds left. I wanted to ask you if you see any movement forward in Congress on aid to Puerto Rico, especially in light of the president's opposition. Should we expect any good news?
From Congress right now, I can't see any good news coming. What I see is there are some people in the Democratic Party that I think are genuinely interested in delivering some aid to Puerto Rico, but they are deadlocked against Republicans who are just as interested in politicizing this issue. And it's not clear how that's going to be resolved yet. I think the hope that there is in this situation comes from Puerto Ricans themselves or ourselves. And I think it is high time for Puerto Ricans to organize ourselves and demand independence, demand decolonization. And my hope is with the people of Puerto Rico.
Well, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Michigan by Dr. Adriana Garriga-Lopez. She's department chair and associate professor of anthropology at Kalamazoo College. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.